You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, we're in the United States, where the legal teams on both sides of the Russia investigation have met. Does this mean it will trickle back down to the president? My guests, Carlo Bonura and Xenia Wickett, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the resignation of Myanmar's president and what that means for the leadership of the nation. Donald Trump doing, once again, exactly what his advisors told him not to do. And meet your worst neighbours, calling the FBI on you because you were flying a Malaysian flag. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests today are Carlo Bonura, who's a senior teaching fellow in Southeast Asian politics at SOAS, and Xenia Wickett, the head of the US and Americas program at Chatham House. A warm welcome to you both. Good to have you with us here on the program. Let's start today's Midori House in the United States, where the ongoing investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller continues to provoke an angry reaction from the US President Donald Trump. In an unprecedented move, attorneys on both sides have met to discuss the issues at the centre of the ongoing investigation. Xenia Wickett, I'll come to you first of all. Rather interesting that you get this sort of powwow and oh, to be a fly on the wall, etc. What do you think the tenor of that discussion might have been?
So I think, there's a whole load of new energy going on in the United States around the Mueller investigation, around the lawyers. I mean, there's a lot of little change. And I do wonder whether we're at a pivot point, if you will. So, you know, one of the things that's happening is there's all sorts of rumors that Donald Trump is going to fire or let go, if we're going to be nice, a number of his lawyers. He has just hired a new lawyer. So the tenor of his legal team has changed from a conciliatory, let's sit down with the other side, let's figure out if we can find a way to work together on questions, and Trump could actually, you know, let's play nice in the sandbox, as it were. But the emphasis on the Trump side is moving now towards, you're going to do this to us? Okay. You know, we'll bring it, kind of thing. And I do wonder whether that change on the Trump legal team is then going to play out in the broader conversation, because you're getting, you know, Trump has made it absolutely clear that he's going to do whatever he wants to do. What he clearly wants to do, although he denies it, is fire Mueller. I mean, he wants the investigation done. He wants it ended. If it's not going to happen naturally in the short term, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen naturally in the short term, then he really wants to fire Mueller. Now, where it gets really interesting to me is if he tries to do that. Now, he actually legally can't, but if he gets the Deputy Attorney General who works for Sessions, a gentleman by the name of Rosenstein, to fire Mueller, then in my view, all hell breaks loose. And so even though it looks like actually things at one level have been moving forward slowly, and thus far, you know, while Mueller has investigated a number of people, has brought charges against a number of people, it doesn't seem to have stuck to the president himself. If he tries to fire Mueller, I think all bets are off. And then you've got a really different situation. And so I think we're at a really interesting point as to whether he'll be reined in again, or whether he'll be allowed to do what he wants to do and then watch the space.
Yeah, well, that motif of him being reined in or otherwise we'll be returning to during the programme. And Carla, that's an interesting point to reflect on, isn't it? At one level, it seems almost more conciliatory to have the two legal teams meeting. One imagines this sort of nice, you know, polite conversation. But in a way, as Xenia suggests there, it could be presaging like an acceleration towards I mean, if that scenario she describes there is, you're in full-blown kind of constitutional crisis territory.
Yeah. I think that what Trump is realizing very quickly is that, and this has been communicated to him by his lawyers, is that Mueller isn't going to go away. Also, just in terms of the, just quickly, I think it's very difficult to actually assess what's going on within the White House. You mentioned some of the rumors, but not simply about his lawyers, but also about his staff, the cabinet members. And what I find interesting is that some of these rumors obviously have gained traction and become reality. But if you remember back in January, we were being told that because Mueller had begun to inquire about interviewing the president, that this meant that, you know, given the method of investigation that federal prosecutors use, that in fact the inquiry was about to wrap up. But actually, 2 months down the line, it's still very active. I think he is, or it's clear from the reporting today that he's very, or at least the rumors, reported in the reporting.
The rumors are clear.
Exactly. Yeah. The rumors are clear that he's somewhat angry about how long this is taking, and that these negotiations are signaling to him, in fact, that there is more to come. In terms of the constitutional crisis, I think this is, appreciate the analysis, and I understand how it could be constitutional. But I think that before we get to the constitutional crisis, that if he were to fire Mueller, we'd actually have a real deep political crisis for the Republican Party, because he is he has already tested and pushed back against congressional leadership. He's demonstrated that he can't really work with them except in let's say extreme conditions, and. If there are some people, for instance, members of Congress, like, let's say, Trey Gowdy, who look at themselves as members of Congress with integrity, and they will be hard-pressed to actually support the president and not move for some type of impeachment proceedings if he goes through with that.
And I just want to pick up, I think Carla's absolutely right. I don't want to suggest that this is a constitutional crisis.
I think I
this is potentially... Okay, it's all your fault. It always is. It is potentially a legal crisis. This could end up going to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
It's not clear that even though there are, you know, broadly defined five conservatives on the Supreme Court and four liberals, that it would necessarily go in Trump's favor. But you definitely have a political crisis because, as Carla says, if Trump effectively tries to fire Mueller by firing somebody else or moving somebody else on. So, I mean, you know, there's a chain reaction that the outcome of which is Mueller would be fired or Mueller would be constrained. I think you would have, even the Republicans in Congress would rise up. I mean, this would be a real problem. And that's where, as I say, it gets really interesting, because until now, for the most part, the Republicans have stood by Trump.
Or simply been inactive.
Or kept quiet. Exactly. Yeah.
And do you think, Carlo, if we follow that analogy, I know this is only one potential way this could go, but is Trump aware, because we're going to talk later in the program about whether he's aware of things and then chooses to ignore a piece of advice, for example, or whether he just simply doesn't think of it. Is he aware that many on the Hill and elsewhere view it as inevitable that if he, say, moved against Mueller, it's likely an impeachment would follow? Do you think he understands that?
I'm sure that he understands that at a very basic level. I think one of the things to take away from his presidency so far is that when he goes to voters, he's going to say that I delivered so far two things. One is tax reform, and the second is deregulation. And that first element, which has not necessarily been a proactive agenda, but instead simply reversing Obama's legacy. So there's not much vision there. But that second element has been done strictly at the executive, you know, through executive privilege or through executive powers. And so I think that we have to ask ourselves if Trump really understands that he needs Congress for anything. You know, does he see Congress as an institution which he at any level has to work with? And if that's the case, then I think if he sees that his own power coming from these executive moves and through these forms of deregulation, and he sees the power of the presidency through that lens, then to him, he may understand that there's a kind of political wall that he's going to go up against, but he may not even care.
The other thing just to think about, I mean, we've seen Trump, Trump is a risk. A, he's a risk taker in his businesses. He's very much a risk taker. And B, he loves conflict. That is his style, is to have conflict. And so he has taken that kind of how he approached his businesses and he's brought that into the presidency. And so if you put yourself in his head, which is a possibly scary thought, but if you put yourself in his head, you know, he is incredibly combative. He has no problem fighting against Congress. He has no problem fighting against his staff and within his staff, with his legal team. That to him isn't something he needs to be concerned with. And he's a risk taker. So, you know, in his experience, if you push back hard, if you fight back hard, in the end, the chips will fall your way. And so to some extent, the calculation he could be going through is, you know, all of these lawyers, they're wanting me to be, you know, nice and play nicely in the sandbox. But my experience says I push back and I push back hard and I embrace that conflict and I'm going to win out in the end. And so it may be that he knows what you've discussed, that he knows that this could be a real problem. But his approach to business that he appears to have been taking in the presidency is very much to take one of, yeah, but if I come out hard and I push hard, I'll win.
And Carl, just before we move on, and we will return to Trump later, sadly, or, you know, interestingly, on the sort of Trump who's he get rid of next bingo game that I like to play, will it be a member of his senior legal counsel? People are already saying, you know, H.R. McMaster's in the firing line. Is there an obvious place that Trump will look next to change things up? He seems to be doing this in an almost cyclical way, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure that we can predict who exactly. And in fact, the cabinet can be split into two camps in terms of who's the next candidate. Those members of the cabinet who are themselves in deep political trouble, like it seems like Ben Carson is under new pressure because of this table setting that his wife allegedly purchased. And then you have this string of more central cabinet figures. But obviously, and this is not anything novel to say at this stage, he's obviously settling into the notion that presidents can surround themselves with people who agree with him. We saw that with Tillerson leaving, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the nature of the replacements in the future.
Well, indeed, and we'll sort of pick up on that theme, but somewhere else in the world, as we move on to Myanmar now, where the president, Tin Jaw, has resigned following health issues, as we are led to understand. Carla, just coming back to you straight away on this, Tin Jaw was a key sort of ally of Aung San Suu Kyi, and she's the sort of state councillor or whatever. You know, she can't take the role, but he was there as a yes man. Do you think that whoever takes that position matters, or is all that matters what Aung San Suu Kyi decides? And ultimately, she will decide who takes that role, of course.
Yeah, this is a good question, because the person matters for two reasons, and neither of the reasons are reasons which we would expect from the role of a president. First, it matters to Aung San Suu Kyi because her role in the government of Myanmar, or Burmese government, is absolutely critical. She's not going to give up this role, which is effectively a kind of informal executive. And so that person has to be an ally of her ally, a close confidant, a member of the National League for Democracy, who is from within her own political circles. And the second reason why the person matters is that person has to be capable of actually working with the military. So we're not talking about the president in any type of, again, to go back to this language of executive authority. The president here is not going to have some executive authority that we would normally expect in a system, the kind of quasi-democratic system or national system. But actually, it has a very important political role, both as a anchor for Aung San Suu Kyi's own position, and also as in relationship to satisfying the needs of very cynical and suspicious members of military leadership.
And that's an interesting point, isn't it? And if we reflect on that, this idea that in some ways you may be better served if you were in, say, Aung San Suu Kyi's position, Zenia, to have somebody in this role who, sure, may be have a collegiate attitude, but maybe who does push back a little and offer something of a buffer from the military. I mean, could it be expedient to actually have someone who's not maybe right on the inner circle, but maybe has a slightly more expansive view for her?
I think it depends on your approach on leadership. And I mean, you know, we've seen all sorts of different types of leadership around the world. You know, we were just talking about Donald Trump and the fact that he is increasingly surrounding himself by people who are yes men. You know, I used to work on South Asia. You know, it was very clear that Pakistani President Musharraf surrounded himself by yes men. And as a result, after a number of years, stopped actually seeing reality as reality was. Mm-hmm. And then you have other leaders who are actually quite prepared to surround themselves with people who aren't yes men or women. You know, and again, just to give an example, you know, George Bush, you know, we talk all the time about, well, was Cheney really the president? You know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, I mean, the list was long, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, of people who were clearly their own person. Mm. And, you know, whether you agreed with Bush or not, he surrounded himself with smart people with different opinions, sometimes, at times. And so, you know, if Aung San Suu Kyi, I mean, what is clear, you know, as Carla said, is she wields the power. Yeah. But if she's willing to kind of open herself up to somebody who might say different things, who might provide other functions like being a good conduit to the military and being able to manage that relationship in a way that maybe she can't, that could be a real positive. But she has to be pretty confident to accept somebody in what is at least rhetorically the position of power. Mm. You know, and we have seen time and again, you know, and I think Colombia is a great case where leaving presidents put in place people they think are just going to be a cipher for them, who turn out to then say, ah, no, I've got my own opinions. So, yeah. You know, it can play differently than the people anticipate.
And what about, Colin, the timings here? I guess it's inevitable. I mean, there's been suggestions that Tindall's been in, you know, ill health or being frail for a while. He's in his early 70s, I think. Nevertheless, people, particularly from without, quick to suggest that this must be connected to the Rohingya crisis, the mismanagement of that. You know, is he a fall guy? Understandable, yes. But, I mean, do you think there's anything to that? I mean, could it be expedient for Aung San Suu Kyi to sort of help Tindall out to try and paper over some of the cracks, which are still there? They're fissures almost as a result of the mishandling of that crisis.
Yeah, I don't think that it has much connection. And actually, the clearest way to look at this is the difference in the coverage between Southeast Asian presses, how they've covered this, and like, let's say, The Guardian this morning, how they covered his death. And actually, if you looked at the headlines over the course of the day, The Guardian's coverage actually retreated from the original claim, which was that this was all about the Rohingya issue. Within the region, there's very little connection between the two. We have to remember that, I mean, from an international perspective and also from a humanitarian perspective, the Rohingya crisis matters a lot. In terms of domestic politics, the Rohingya crisis is simply one of numerous instances of ethnic conflict within Burma. And then it is to a Burman majority, the Rohingya crisis is not what you're going to judge or assess Aung San Suu Kyi's presidency on. So this is certainly, I think, and also in terms of policymaking, we have to remember that Aung San Suu Kyi does not control the wings of the government or the military that are responsible for the violence. Certainly she could, politically she could engage with the crisis differently. But again, she has to deal with the military leadership, and that anything which would demonstrate to either to her voters or to the military that she is not taking a firm line on Rohingya citizenship, especially, which is something we don't really talk that much about, but the crisis more generally would be seen as, I think, weakness on her part.
And just very briefly, some people also suggest that if there's any procrastination about filling this role or it's filled unsatisfactorily, that will almost necessarily prompt certain figures in the military to start to look again. And we know that there seems to be a willingness from the military to get more involved. Is it wrong to worry about that, or is that always there in the background?
That's a good question. If it's always there in the background, I think many people believe that this process is fairly well entrenched, predominantly because the military have a substantial remain in control of a substantial amount of authority in Myanmar. If there are problems in filling this role, either because Aung San Suu Kyi can't find the right person, which I don't think will be the case, or because the military tries to interrupt the process, then I think we can see that this will not bode well for the country. One last point is that, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi, I would argue, is fairly autocratic. You know, she has consolidated her authority within the National League for Democracy. And it's not simply in her political interest to pick someone who's very close to her, but also I would argue it's a reflection of how she's run the party as well.
We'll talk about vexillology and your mastery of that. Yeah. People are looking at me curiously in the studio. All will become clear. But let's talk more Trump first up with Carlo Venera and Xenia Wickett. What would you do if you were a leader of a nation and all your advisors told you not to do something? If you're imagining you'd be the current leader of the US, you probably know the answer. After a press conference on Tuesday, where Trump confirmed he had indeed congratulated Putin on his electoral victory in Russia, it's emerged that he did so despite most of his national security advisors telling him not to do so, including writing briefing materials with, in caps, "Do not congratulate." Pretty clear, Xenia. Had you provided a document with that degree of clarity to, I don't know, the leader of the free world, would you be fairly frustrated? Or actually, would you be sanguine because you would be thinking, ignoring that is precisely what I would expect him to do?
I'm going to avoid both of those options. having written a number of these briefing memos to the US president a number of years ago, you write the briefing memos because you think they're going to be read. You know, you wouldn't bother otherwise. That being said, this president in particular apparently does not like reading the memos, likes much more having conversations with people. So, you know, the question that I would ask is if the way that this president likes to get information is through conversation rather than through memos, did they also make clear in the conversation that he should not congratulate? Because if the memo is not being read, then there's no point in having capitals at the top of the memo. You know, I mean, that just, you know, doesn't make any sense. That being said, I mean, it's the prerogative of the president or the national security advisor or whoever to actually take the approach that they think is right. If one puts aside for a moment what we all seem to be so fixated on, which is, you know, Donald Trump's kind of rhetoric and kind of outrageous style, at least for a president, you can make a perfectly valid argument that says, actually, yes, we have lots of problems with Russia. We also have a lot that we need to do with Russia. And so actually maintaining a, you know, and given that Putin is essentially almighty in Russia, maintaining some kind of a working relationship with him is probably the way to go. Now, the reality is that most people say yes, but not under the conditions where he's presiding over, you know, elections that aren't free and fair, not under the conditions where he is treating his people in certain ways. And, you know, one of the, I thought it was very pointed and very interesting to read Macron's response was to congratulate not President Putin, but to congratulate the Russian people, you know, and Russia, which again is a slightly, it's nuanced, but in diplomacy we see this. So I wouldn't get too worried about him not reading. I'm not wildly surprised that he hasn't read, and he has the prerogative to take the road that he thinks is right.
I do get a little worried that he's not. I'm trying to work out if it's less bad that he doesn't read it or that he reads it and ignores it. I can't decide which is better or worse, if you follow my logic. Carlo, what about to the point that someone like, you know, John McCain has said, you know, this is an insult for Trump, actually, to every Russian whose vote essentially is rendered meaningless by the process. I wonder, does that really get traction stateside? Certainly, again, we imagine Trump himself won't be bothered about that.
Yeah, I think what's fascinating about this Russia issue, including the, and I'll go as far to say the hysteria around the Mueller investigation, our obsession with it, for better or for worse, is that Trump has induced a kind of schizophrenia in the United States on Russia in a way which makes it very, very difficult on a daily basis to actually figure out what we should really believe about Russia. So if you think, even under the Obama administration, foreign policy hawks, whether within the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, were convinced that Russia was ascendant. Geopolitically, Russia was the American imagination about, the American political imagination about Russia was retooling itself to prepare itself for another Cold War. And actually, the position that Corbyn took here in the UK on the spy, the murder of the Russian spy, was a position that we would expect from certain elements of the Democratic Party, which was, we need to be calm, we don't want to do anything rash, and perhaps some of this this new momentum on Russia geopolitically is potentially misplaced. But what we find in the United States right now is Democrats demanding that, like kind of leftist Democrats, demanding that Russia be harder demanding that Trump be harder on Russia, that the meddling is a geopolitical provocation. And then people on the right, we have the same thing. Certainly conservative Trump supporters seeing all references to Russia as a distraction, geopolitical or otherwise. And he has completely unmoored this this sign, to be a little bit analytical about this, called Russia in a way which is completely confusing to, I'm sure, the American populace, public, which means that it may not get any traction whatsoever, and certainly infuriating to people like John McCain.
So I just wanted to add, what I think is really interesting about this story is the bit that I can't imagine is that your White House senior staff would leak to the press that, you know, this is what we wrote on the notes and the president has ignored it. You know, the bit that I think is really telling is the fact that, you know, I can't even start to imagine working in the White House and then calling up somebody in the press saying, you know what, he said this and this is what we told him to say.
Well, and presumably and there can only be a relatively small, we know that his inner circle is sort of shrunk even further than it was a few months ago. There can only be a few people who are providing that kind of information, though.
One would imagine.
Well, but I mean, that's what's so interesting. We keep getting this information. I mean, you know, the amount of leaking that's coming out of the White House and other parts of the US government is just phenomenal about things that you, under normal circumstances, even if as a diplomat or a civil servant or even a political appointee, you would disagree with the direction that your government's policy is going, and that happens all the time, you wouldn't think about leaking some of this stuff. And I mean, clearly, the fact that we know exactly the language that was written on the memo says that somebody's doing that.
And the font details. What about to that point, this unmooring? I thought it was really interesting what Carlo was saying about this unmooring and this sort of paranoia or hysteria, whatever you want to call it. Is it really possible for Trump to just push the button so much that that happens that quickly? You know, one imagines that the established worldview is sufficiently entrenched that it would take more than 18 months.
I will take Carlo's unmooring and double it, or whatever the right expression is. You know, the reality is that, you know, the generic descriptions that we have been using for decades about what makes a Democrat and what makes a Republican, you know, Democrats or Republicans are hawks, they're fiscal conservatives, they're small government, you know, all of these kind of things. And Democrats are, you know, slightly wishy-washy on defense and international affairs, very kind of, you know, human rights and, you know, socially conscious and all the rest of it. And that has been completely turned over in the last, you know, year to 2 years running into the election. You know, no longer, you know, white working class are no longer standard Democrats. They're now sitting in the Republican camp. Clinton was more hawkish than was, you know, Trump. Trade, again, another issue that historically the Republicans have been free traders, the Democrats have been more protectionist. You know, that's turned around. I mean, many of the generic descriptors that we have used for the two parties need to be thrown out the window. And the thing that I keep arguing is we can no longer even think in terms of two parties. We have to, at a minimum, think in terms of four parties at the moment, because there are at least two factions on the Democratic side that are quite clear and two factions on the Republican side that are quite clear. I mean, there's a whole myriad more, but we've got to come up with a whole new language.
Well, now, just in a minute, I want to ask you briefly about this Malaysian flag that was flown in Kansas by Munir Zanial. He hung out at a party. Some people mistook it for an American flag with ISIS symbols and called the feds on him. Just briefly, Carlo, is this in a weird way a kind of manifestation of a different sort of similar paranoia and suspicion of one's neighbours, which is maybe influenced by some of this Trumpian rhetoric and the general sort of bad smell that lingers around at the moment?
I wish it were that. I think that it's a gross generalization to say that middle America knows very little about the world. And in addition to that, the United States has a very healthy track record in terms of geopolitical misrecognition by its citizens. If you remember after 9/11, there were Sikhs who were attacked because people thought that they were Muslims. The irony here, of course, is that Malaysia is, of all the countries within the Muslim world, perhaps the only country that has been able to sell itself internationally at the global level as being the model of moderate Islam, regardless of the reality of that claim. And so here, it's the very flag that people associate with ISIS. I'm sure that Najib Razak, the prime minister, is just completely mortified by this.
Well, and is there a sort of a supreme irony that if we're trying to be kind of positive in some way about this, then we can sort of enjoy, or does this speak to the deep-rootedness of a lack of intercultural and interreligious understanding that is, in a way, tied back to the man in the Oval Office?
I don't think there's anything positive from this story that we can gather at all. What it says is that the level of fear in the United States, the level of kind of in-group, out-group, you're not, if you don't look like me, then there's got to be something wrong with you, is so great that, you know, people don't think to ask a question before they act. To go to the FBI and actually, as this group did, and say, look, there's, ISIS supporters here, without actually thinking twice, Googling what the flag is, there's nothing good there at all.
Nothing good there at all.
Sorry.
But we did get to some vexillology right near the end. That's a study of flags, by the way. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Carlo Venura and Zeni Wickett, thank you both for joining us. Today's programme was produced by Carlotta Rubello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis, and our studio manager was David Stevens. My name's Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.